I'm Jerry, I'm an alcoholic.
Jerry.
When I first got sober, I was attending multiple fellowships, and it was in this meeting that Rick was there, and it was a big meeting. I really liked it. There's a lot of great recovery there. There was people there in the book, and got to know Rick pretty well, I guess, you know, from the meeting, and, you know, we'd go around and share at some point, and I would always stop and actually listen to what he had to say. He always had something fun and constructive to say. And I was probably getting around where it was my third step, and at this time I thought my sponsor was the only one that knew anything about the Big Book. And he wasn't going to be able to work with me, so we're right before step four, so at that crucial point he kind of dumps me off on not only on Rick, on his brother, and somehow I end up in Rick's house in his basement. And we're going through the book, and lo and behold, it's just like my sponsor does it. I'm like, there's another guy that knows something about the Big Book. There's two. And that's what I really believed. And then I heard Dante knew something about the book, too, so we asked him anyways, and he spoke about a month ago. And it was really, it's really neat to see someone that does what we do, works with people in the book for all this time, and is still standing around to talk about it. That will give you a rip.
I'm Rick. I'm an alcoholic and an addict.
Hey, Rick.
March 10th, let me make sure this thing's off. March 10th of 2015, a few months ago, I picked up my 25-year chip. And in a couple of more months, in September, I'll be 50. So it dawned on me on the way down here that I'm almost to the point that I've been sober half my life. You know, there's for me to tell my story, there's really kind of three parts to it. You know, there's three kind of phases of my life. The first one, actually the third one would be the last 25 years. My introduction into the Big Book, which was almost day number one of 25 years ago. Then prior to that, there was years between 10 and 25 years old. There was a 15-year span in there, and that's my using years, and I'll get to how I ended up. This is a recorder. I thought it was somebody's phone. I'll get into in a minute how I started. You know, I came about being 10 years old when I really kind of went off the deep end. It'll make sense in a minute. And then there was the years prior to that, zero through 10. You know, and I can sum those years up pretty easily. I was a good kid. I was happy. I made good grades. You know, I was real athletic. I lettered in the things you could letter in. I got trophies in the things you could trophy in. You know, and all that. And so things were pretty good in my life. There was one negative that was kind of a big negative in my life. Even though I was sort of this happy little kid when I was young, my dad. I had a dad who he died drunk driving on Holcomb Bridge when I was 17. He was a raging alcoholic, practicing drug addict. He was Italian, and that kind of what kind of goes along with that is a wick about this long with your temper, you know. He was a power lifter. He was a really big guy. I've seen him bench, 500 and 525 pounds. He was a big old guy. He was mean as hell, he was a former two-time Golden Gloves boxing champion, so he could fight. So you put all that together, and you had, you had a kind of a disaster, And when he would get drunk, he would get really violent, And it got to the point that my mom left my dad. It was like one of those made-for-TV movies when you see them, they get up in the middle of the night, and the dad's passed out drunk, and the wife sneaks out the back window with the kids and all that. That was us. And so we left. And, keep in mind that back then, I was pretty young. My mom was probably 21 or 22 years old. She had three kids. I'm the youngest of three. I have a sister who's a year older than me, and then my brother is about almost 3 years older than me. And my mom was uneducated, didn't have a job and never had a real job, was now single and had three kids she had just left. And you'd be surprised, left your husband, so you'd be surprised how little, how few friends you have when you're in her position, you know, and she was trying to find a place for us to stay. So we ended up in government housing, okay? And this was in Nashville. That's where I was born. And we were, you know, we lived in the projects, you know? We really had nowhere else to go. So that's where we ended up. And I always thought it was kind of ironic that y'all used to buy dope from my neighbors, you know? That's where we were where everybody was coming. I remember that, you know? But we lived there for a few years, and obviously it was bad. I mean, there was rats in the walls and roaches in the cabinets and the whole bit, and, you know, gunfire wasn't on TV. It was out the window and the whole bit. So my mom got tired of that after a while, and we left, and I remember we moved up in life, and we went and moved into my grandmother's attic. And that was a step up for us. I remember when we got there, that my grandmother lived in a house in Nashville. It was a two-bedroom house. She was in one bedroom. One of my aunts and my sister were in, they like shared another bedroom. And upstairs was the attic. And it was one of these, not a drop down where you pulled the little thing, not those kind of stairs, but somebody had made it where you could open up a door and sort of duck down and walk up a flight of stairs. And up there, they had thrown a bathroom and painted the walls. And there was four beds up there. One of them was for my mom. One was for another aunt who was a big pothead at the time. That's where we used to get all my weed when I was 10. Me and my brother shared a bed, and our grandfather, we called him Daddy Cox, who when I grew up, I realized that he too was a raging alcoholic. He kind of crashed in the other bedroom, you know, the other bed. So there was like nine of us or something living in this house. And I was proud of it, because where we came from, that was like a step up. You know, I had like a house, and it had like a front door that was there's no hallways and the whole bit, you know, but it was at that time, we were still in a real poor area of town. And, you know, you have to keep in mind that my brother, especially when I was young, I was like 9, and he was 12, and he was like, he was that kid, I don't know, I remember this specifically, that he was that kid that when he was 12, he looked like he was, you know, 16. He had like a full beard, you know, or something. You know, it was like, he just seemed like he looked so much older than he was. And so because of that, he hung out with 15 and 16-year-old kids because he kind of looked like that age. So the end result was kind of like the domino effect. When I was hanging out with him, he was hanging out with 15-year-old kids. Even though we weren't in the hood anymore, we were in a pretty bad area of town still. I mean, my grandmother lived in a poor area. And, you know, my mom, she put herself through Vanderbilt, you know, so she went and she got three part-time jobs, and she was putting herself through school. So she literally would get up in the morning and go to work, and then she would leave there and go to school and come home. And so the end result was we were kind of flying solo, you know, and I would be running around outside, you know, kind of, me and my brother and our sister too. And kids in the area that we lived in, that were 14 and 15 and 16 years old, they were smoking weed. You know, they were back then, Quaaludes were real big, you know, and Valium and meth was real big. We called it crank back then, you know, and everybody was kind of into all that stuff. They were at their age, and not that it's, you know, now that I have kids who are older than 15 and 16 now, but so I realized how young it was. But back then I was 9 to 10 years old, and I was running around doing all that shit, and I had like no idea I was smoking. I remember when the first time I started smoking, pot and cigarettes, my lungs were, I was so young still that I remember it took me a while before I could inhale. It was like a big step. I remember trying to hit a joint and kind of going, you know, and I would just start gagging and coughing and, you know, whatever. And I had to like, it took me a couple of weeks before I could do it, you know, but everybody else was doing it. And I remember thinking, well, I'm supposed to be smoking this and inhaling and doing what they're doing. So because of that, I truly started at a pretty young age, at a really young age. And it was no time at all that you know, it started to become what we did for fun. You know, it wasn't necessarily that I had a drug problem when I was, you know, 10 and 11 and 12, but it's what we did for fun. And so, and then that kind of started, you know, the fun part started wearing out, where we would go out, we'd get wasted. And then we'd get bored. It used to be getting wasted was enough, and then we'd be wasted and bored, so then we started getting into, like, vandalism. So I went through these years where I was, like, you know, tearing up all kinds of shit. Then one day I started realizing instead of tearing it up, some of this is keepable, you know, so then I started stealing. And this was back in the days when, like, pawn shops, didn't, you know, they didn't ask for an ID. You know, you could just grab, you know, sterling silver, you know, silverware and walk into a pawn shop and give it to them. They give you money, you leave, you know. So it was real easy to steal stuff or to, you know, get rid of it. And since we were poor and, you know, I was getting more and more into using and you know, drinking and all this, you know, for me to be able to do it, that just kind of went hand in hand. So needless to say, that ended up, it went from me, you know, partying a lot and getting, you know, messed up with my friends to then we got into vandalism, and then we went from that into deciding we could keep a lot of this stuff, and then we started doing it on purpose. We would go out and we would break into people's houses. And then that kind of evolved. We started getting kind of ballsy, and we started breaking into people's houses when they were in there asleep, you know. And you know, I was, you know, 12, 13 years old running around, you know, I've done it 100 times, be sitting right next to somebody's bed with mom and dad would be asleep, you know, going grabbing the guy's wallet and getting her rings and the whole bit. Not having any idea that what I was doing could get me killed, you know. It was just like what I did. It was like a gradual process of what I was doing. And, you know, next thing I know, I'm 13 years old. I start getting arrested a lot. And every time I got arrested, it was a possession charge with it. You know, there was something, I always had something in my pocket. I was, you know, underage drinking or had, you know, weed or, you know, I got into like cocaine and all this other stuff. So I started having heavier stuff with me. And they kind of frowned on that, you know. And since I was young, you know, I started getting in more and more trouble, and the charges started getting more serious. But finally, you know, somewhere in there, my mom started realizing, okay, things aren't going real well, you know. And so she started trying to intervene. And when I was, I want to say I was 13 or 14 years old, I had three different possession charges and some other assault charges and some other stuff. But I used to get arrested all the time, you know, for just all kinds of crazy stuff. And I had three different cases pending against me. And my mom went to the judge, she went to several different judges. This is probably impossible to do now in, you know, today's day and age. But back then, she was able to get all those cases all merged together in one. So I had one court date with all the cases and charges together in front of one judge, okay? And so I went. Well, of course, I had no choice but to go, but we go to court, and the end result was the judge gave me one of two decisions or options or whatever. And the first one was I could go to juvenile till I was 18 because I'd been arrested. There was more to it than just the possession charges. I'm leaving some of it out because I don't want y'all to, like, you know, get up and leave or anything. You know, it was serious enough stuff that I was going to be locked up till I was 18. I think I might have been 13, almost 14 by now. Or go to rehab, you know. And so really quickly I realized that I had always thought I had a drug problem. Not really, I was kidding. You know, I said that to the judge. When I found out that this was my out, you know, that I could go to rehab, then I wouldn't go to jail. Well, of course, I'm like, yes, sir. You know, I've been struggling a long time trying to stop, you know. So I get court ordered into a rehab, you know. And as soon as I got there, it was a place down in Florida is where I ended up going. And as soon as I got there, within, you know, one day, I realized that I had made a drastic mistake, you know, that I would rather be in jail than in this damn place. It was one of these sort of lockdown kind of places, you know. So I started thinking of ways to get out. And like I said, it was a lockdown place. Everywhere you went, you were escorted. You know, the doors had bars and, you know, there was always people with you and all that kind of stuff. And the only way I could think of to get out was in some form or fashion would be assault. So that's just the way my brain worked. And so they kind of kept weapons. They kept knives and stuff away from us. But we had to do a lot of writing, and I had a big pen. And you know, we were walking outside. We were going from, you know, one building to the next, and I thought, this is my opportunity. This guy that was walking with me, so I reached behind him and grabbed the back of his head and stabbed him in the neck with this pen. And, you know, it sounds kind of crazy, right? But at the time, I swear to God, it's like it never, you know, my brain was just so fried, and all the stuff that I was doing, it just was natural to me, you know. Just, I wanted to get out, and I was going to get out, you know. But what happened was the guy scared him so bad, he grabbed me and froze. It was like he like locked up. We actually later became really good friends, but we did, you know. But he said that I scared him so bad he thought that I had killed him, even though he was still there. He in his brain later he told me that he thought he was dead. Like he felt it and he knew that I had just stabbed him in the neck and it went in pretty far. I don't know how I didn't do something serious to the guy. But I ended up getting tackled and all this other kind of stuff. You know, all these people come running over. I just knocked something over. And so needless to say, I didn't get out. And so now they really started coming down kind of hard on me. And so, you know, I went through this phase where I realized, okay, I'm going to have to go along with this. I'm going to have to go with the flow or I'm never going to get out of here. And I remember the whole time I was there, even all the bad stuff that had happened to me, you know, and all the stuff that I was into, had been going on, I still didn't want to be there. I remember wanting to get out and get back to party, and I felt like I was really missing out on a lot of stuff. But I knew I had to go along to get along, so that's what I did. And I ended up, I was there for, you know, hell, like almost a year, you know, something like that. It was a long time for I, you know, faked them out to let me out. But finally I got out, and within 1 week, I went right back where I was. Within literally like 2 or 3 weeks after that, I became a junkie. You know, I you know, they talk about how when you stop, there's a progressive disease and it gets worse. You don't stop, you don't pick up where you left off and all that stuff. And I've experienced that. I've relapsed probably 250 times. And I'm telling you, every single time I would not pick up where I left off. I would pick up where I would have been had I kept going, you know, and that's what I did there. You know, I stopped, got out first opportunity I had. I was, I was, you know, all of a sudden doing pills and smoking and all that stuff wasn't enough. And I found needles, you know, and started doing that. And I was like 16 to 17 years old, you know. But like I said, you know, none of this seemed out of line to me, you know. you know, people talk about your bottoms and all that. You know, I look back, I really believe that I hit a bottom, and I hit a bottom young, but I was perfectly content and thought that was normal, you know. A lot of that had to do with my dad, you know, because I was exposed to him. You know, I feel like I should probably touch a little bit on my relationship with my dad, because it was, on one hand, it was really, really screwed up, you know, but on the other hand, I looked up to the guy, you know. You know, like I said, he was, you know, when my mom first left him, he ended up, we disappeared, and he eventually ended up moving to Memphis. We were living in Nashville. He moved to Memphis, and we didn't see him for, you know, a group of years. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, there's like a knock at the door, and my mom opens the door, and there's my dad. And it wasn't we weren't all excited. We were all like, oh, shit, you know, he found us. We're going to get shot right now, you know. And he convinced her that, you know, she had filed for and been granted a divorce, you know, so they were divorced. And he basically, to summarize, he understood that they were not going to get back together. But he convinced her that he had changed and that he was no longer violent, that he had tapered way down on drinking, and that he wanted to have his kids in his life. And my mom fell for it. And I remember when they were talking, I remember thinking, don't go for this. Don't believe this shit. I'm telling you, I just knew, even though I was young, I just knew that this was not going to be good. But she fell for it. You know, I don't want to say she fell for it. In fairness to her, you know, I think that she, you know, and as an adult, I understand, you know, the importance of having your mom and your dad, even if they're not perfect, you know, little kids, you know, young kids need that in their lives. And so next thing I know, I'm going off to, you know, the summer vacation. We were living in Nashville. He was living in Atlanta. That's how I ended up down here is, you know, I would come down and see him for Christmas, you know, and then it was, you know, Thanksgiving too. And then it was the summer for a few weeks. And then it was the whole summer, you know, and then I ended up, he convinced my mom to let me come down here and live with him. I lived with him for like 2 years, and it was just total pure hell the whole time. He was, like I said, he was very abusive. One day I would give you one little example, you know, like what it was like, you know. I was, you know, probably, you know, maybe 7 or 8, you know, something like that. I was pretty young, and he had remarried this lady who was pregnant and with child already. And so I ended up with a little brother, a little stepbrother, and a little stepsister. And I was outside. We were out in the woods, and my little stepbrother was riding a little dirt bike. And I had his BB gun. I was just playing around shooting leaves or whatever. And I was just kidding around with him, and he was going to ride his bike by me, and I was on the path. And I stopped him and said, if you go, I'm going to shoot you. You can't go past this line, whatever. Well, he took me for real. He thought I was going to shoot him. And little did he know, a couple of years later, I probably would have. But so I think he had like a premonition of what I was, you know, where I was eventually heading. But he got all freaked out, started crying, turned the bike around before I could stop him because I knew what he was doing. He turned around and he took off and rode home to my dad's house, which is where I was living at the time. And, you know, of course, you know, 10 minutes later, 5 minutes later, here comes little Michael, and he's like, hey, daddy wants you to come home. And I knew right then, you know, I knew that nothing good was fixing to happen. And so I walked back up to the house, and I can relate to how, you know, guys on death row probably feel when they're walking down the, you know, down that last little hallway. You know, I was walking back in the house, and he met me with a backhand that knocked me almost completely through the sheetrock wall, and he had a shotgun in his hand. And he yanked me up, grabbed me by my shirt, and yanked me up and slammed me up against the wall and put the gun in the back of my throat. And told me that he ought to just blow my fucking head off right here, you know. And, you know, that's pretty heavy for, you know, even at, like, me now, that would probably scare me pretty good. You know? But I was seven, you know, I was 7 or 8 years old. And I remember looking him in his eyes. You know, my dad would get this kind of glazed look. When he would flip like that, he would get this look that you just knew that he was capable of anything, and that really almost like it wasn't even him inside of there. You could just see it, you know. And I learned that look at a really young age, and because I had seen it and I saw it then. And what seemed like an eternity, you know, finally he just kind of, I saw the glazed look kind of clear up a little bit, and I could tell that he sort of came back out of what he was in and, you know, backed off and turned around. Didn't say anything, backed up, just walked upstairs, and I just sort of stood there. I didn't know what I should do. I just stood there for like 15 minutes. I don't know if I should go up or down or, you know, whatever. But my point in that story is that's just like one time, you know, that's just one thing. When I say I had an abusive dad, I mean I had an abusive dad. You know, I didn't have one of these dads, you know, that yelled at you and spanked you one time too many and took your bike away. You know, mine was for real. And which, like I said, is why my mom left. But at the same time, even though he was like that, he was really, really charismatic. Everybody loved my dad. He died when I was 17 years old, and to this day, I will be out somewhere and somebody will bump into me I hadn't seen in forever, and they'll start talking about my dad like he was the greatest thing since sliced bread. You know, he had that side of him that, believe it or not, everybody back then knew that that's how he was. They knew he partied a lot. They knew he was always drinking. He always had beer. He always was, you know, had weed. He was always doing something, always getting in trouble. But he always, what I saw was this craziness on one side and this, you know, party out of control, wild ass on the other side that everybody seemed to like, you know. And that was still my dad, you know. That was the only dad I really knew. So I wanted to be like him, you know. So years later, when I was describing earlier, you know, what my life was kind of turning into. You know, on one hand, people on the outside might have looked at me and thought, you know, this kid's like way out of control. You know, I was more than just out of control. You know, I was becoming him, you know, to a lot of ways. You know, I went to a phase where I was, I went to a phase where I was real violent too, you know. I wasn't, you know, a 500-pound, not 500-pound, but I couldn't bench 500 pounds, but I could carry a weapon, you know, and I wasn't afraid to use it, you know. I had kind of become my dad, and I knew it, and there was a part of me that kind of, like, liked it, you know. I don't know how to explain it any way other than that, but it was like, you know, when you know, I just, you know, felt like that even though he died at the age that he did, and I continued on down my path and I got in a lot more serious trouble later, I remember having thoughts like, you know, I wonder if this is how you know, daddy thought or how he felt in these situations. You know, all this different stuff was going on, and I remember I would find myself kind of thinking, I wonder if this was sort of like if he was having the same thoughts when he was in this kind of shit too, you know, which is kind of a messed up way to, you know, look at it. But anyway, I ended up, you know, I got out of that first rehab and went right back to it and ended up, you know, I had the bad habit of getting arrested. And you know, I ended up, in no time at all, I think I realized once that without getting into a whole bunch of, you know, charges and all that kind of stuff, I realized when I was like maybe 20 or 21 that I had been arrested the same amount of times that years I had lived. So I had been arrested like 20 or 21 times, and I was 20 or 21 years old at that time. But earlier than that, when I was like 18, I ended up getting in a bunch of trouble, and you know, I was on a you know, kind of a, you know, I would have these phases where I would just kind of go off the deep end and would start partying, and it would go on for like 3 weeks, and I wouldn't really remember any of it, you know, but I would end up in jail at the end of it. And this one time, I ended up in jail, and my mom wouldn't get me out, and I stayed down there for like 11 months or 11 and a half months or something like that. And I was facing 15 years, okay? But I really wasn't taking it all that serious. There was just that part of me that I really wasn't worried about it. It was just, I can't explain some of it. You know, I just didn't seem to, I didn't really care. You know, I was facing a bunch of time and it didn't matter. And the DA came to me and wanted to cut me a deal and said that he would let me out for 6 years, that if I signed the paper that I could serve 6 years and I'd be done. And I had a pen in my hand and the paper was in front of me in this little meeting room or whatever. And I was almost gonna sign it, and I just all of a sudden just stopped, and I said, "You know what?" And I slid it back to across the table, and I said, "I tell you what, let me sit on this for a minute." And so I called my mom. I went back to my cell, and I called my mom, and I said, "Look, by this time in my life, she had nothing to do with me. You know, like I would get in jail, I wouldn't even bother to call her anymore because I knew she wasn't gonna come. You know, because she felt safer with me locked up. She used to say that all the time as I got older." That the reason why she never would come bail me out was because she felt like that I wasn't going to be dead in there, that I wasn't going to get shot in jail, you know. But I did get some good dope in jail. But the physical part of it, I was safe, you know. And I called her up and I said, "Look, I'm facing 15 years, and this is serious because the DA is saying that he's got me dead ringer, and he's going. I'm going to serve 6 years if you don't do something." And by this time, she had gotten sort of politically connected. You know, she had worked her way up out of the hole that we started off in. You know, it's a whole story by itself. You could almost do a movie about it. But Ira would understand that one. Actually, not to get sidetracked, but there is a movie about my mom's life story. That's why I made that comment. But anyway, you know, she had sort of moved her way up into, you know, up out of all that and had become successful and was able to make some phone calls. She knew I was fixed to go to prison. And she got, within 48 hours, she got all the charges dropped. And I was walked free and clear. And, you know, I remember getting out, and the lawyer who had gotten me out of that mess wanted to talk to me. And he sat me down. I didn't know who he was, but he sat me down and he told me, he said, "You want to, you know, son, you don't even know who I am, and I really don't know you, but I did this as a favor to your mom." And he said, "I want you to understand what I just did to get you out." And he then proceeded to tell me the story. Apparently this attorney was some big hotshot, you know, powerful attorney down, we're in Florida by now. And he represented this guy, this rich kid, who was a lot like me, not the whole rich part, but a lot like me in that was just constantly in trouble for some real serious stuff. And this kid's dad had a lot of money and was able to retain this attorney. And that attorney had kept this kid out of prison like a whole bunch of charges, a whole bunch of times. And the deal that this attorney had done, had worked out with the DA to get me out, was he had made a deal with the DA, who that kid was, I say that kid, the kid was probably, you know, 25 or something, you know, but to me he's a kid now, that kid had was facing charges for something, and basically the attorney told me that he was going to, you know, flub the case and had agreed to let that guy go to prison on his upcoming charge on the grounds that with the swap was that I was going to walk, okay? So there ended up being somebody that went to prison for me, but not really for me, but you get it, you know, that somebody went to prison. I don't know how long he was there for, or he might even still be there for all I know. But so with hearing that story, even in the midst of all of this, I left, and I remember thinking, you know, wow, you know, I mean, that's pretty serious, you know, to think that there's somebody else going to prison for a bunch of years so that I could get out. And that was the first time that I started thinking, you know, maybe I should stop. Maybe I should sort of, you know, say enough is enough and pull out of this mess before, you know, before the plane goes all the way down. And so that's what I decided to do. I decided I was going to stop. And it was literally like I just had this moment of clarity, and my life just came into focus for just a split second, and I just thought, you know, I'm going nowhere fast. It's like I just realized after living like that I was going straight off a cliff. And so I made the decision. That was the first time I ever made the decision to stop. And of course, y'all know how that went, you know. I think I made it like maybe 48 hours, literally, and was right back doing it again. You know, I'd always start off drinking, and then I'd nip in the heavier stuff, you know. So that was like the first time that I ever stopped and thought, you know, maybe I should stop doing what I'm doing before something bad happens. The next time that happened, that I had not only did I have the desire to quit, but I even got God involved in on it, was I got a bunch of DUIs. You know, of course, DUIs to me were like minor, you know, that was nothing to me at the time. And I probably had like, you know, I don't know, I think I had 6 or 7 DUIs. My brother's told me that he remembers like 10 or 12, but I used to get them like all the time. And this is back when, you know, nowadays you do that. Nowadays, you know, you get a DUI, it's like you're gone to prison. You know, back when I was getting them, I swear it was like, you know, it didn't seem like it was that big a deal. But I went out one night, and this is kind of a humorous story, but it's got a point to it. I went out one night, and I went to a bar on a Tuesday night. This is back in the days, they would do like 3-for-1s, you know. So my understanding is that I think it's illegal now. You can't do that kind of stuff now, but bars used to do it a lot back then. I went to this bar and got hammered and left, was on my way home in my car. And I don't remember this to this day. I'm telling you, I would tell you if I remembered this or if I was aware of it, but I wasn't. But you know, when you see every now and then on TV, there'll be the helicopter and it's following the car and there's like the high speed chase. That was me. I went through one of those, but I didn't know it. I was drunk and I was on the way home, and apparently there was like 14 police cars chasing me for, you know, 45 minutes to an hour. And, you know, doing 140 miles an hour or something until I wrecked off in a ditch. And then they all showed up and, you know, pinned me down and beat me up and the whole bit. And I ended up getting a DUI and 13 tickets, right? They got me tickets for, you know, no proper, like, improper lane change, just any possible thing they could throw at me. And that was on a Tuesday night. Slept in jail all through Wednesday. Woke up, started calling around to find somebody to come get me out of jail. And that happened Thursday. I was in Roswell, as a matter of fact. And that happened on Thursday. My brother actually came and got me. I managed to track him down. And he came and got me out on a Thursday morning and got me back to the house. So I'm back home. Got a pocket full of tickets. I'm beat all to hell because they kind of roughed me up pretty good. And because I was resisting arrest. And I got home and took a shower, got something to eat, took a nap on the couch, and that was like Thursday late afternoon, kind of going into Thursday evening, and just, I decided to get up and go have a drink. You know, I didn't really know what else to do, so the thought crossed my mind, you know, I feel like shit, I've got a bunch of bad problems in my pockets now, and maybe I need to go have a beer or something. So I went back to the same bar, and of course, everybody's wanting to know what happened. I'm back, you know, 48 hours later, and I'm beat all to hell. I'm telling the story. So, of course, I'm sitting there, everybody's laughing, and I get hammered again. Now I'm in a pickup truck. I get hammered again. middle of the night, decided to leave. And once again, I don't remember what happened. I don't remember the details, but the cops said that I was going about 60 miles an hour backwards when I hit this tree. And I don't know exactly what happened, but I remember hitting the tree, and I was in a pickup truck going backwards, and all of a sudden I was like this, you know, and the tree, when it split the tail of the bed in half and broke the axle, and it came through the cab backwards. And I remember going like this and realizing, oh, there's a tree in here. And I got out, and so I knew I needed to walk, you know, and I remember getting out. I can remember bits and pieces of it, and I started walking. I knew to walk away. You know, I knew to get the hell away from this, you know, bad accident I had just seen. And I walked for what seemed like an hour. And I'm walking along, and I found out later I had a concussion and all this other stuff. But I remember I was sort of coming in and out. And I was walking and walking and walking. And after a long time of walking, I saw like an accident up here. And I saw a bunch of cars and cops and the lights going on. So I thought, okay, I need to, you know, kind of be cool here. And so I tried to look presentable, and I was going to walk right past it. And I walked right past it, and I was looking at this accident, and it was a pickup truck that had hit a tree. It was me. I had walked somewhere, like somehow or another, I walked in a big damn circle because I had a concussion. And I ended up back at the scene, and when I realized where I was and what happened, I was like, oh, shit, that was me. And I turned around, and standing right beside me was the first arresting officer from Tuesday night. So he immediately arrested me. Now we got another DUI, and this time I got 14 tickets. So I ended up with two DUIs. And 27 tickets, leaving the same bar by the same cop in 48 hours. And this time the judge would not let me out, okay? He decided, I remember him saying that, you know, that he was afraid that if he let me out that I might kill somebody next time or kill myself, but he was more concerned about the other people. And he told me that. And so he wouldn't do bond or any of that. And I ended up sitting down there in jail that time for like 10 or 11 months again. And my court date came up. And in the time that I had been sitting in jail, sort of sobered up and kind of got back to my, you know, detox to me was jails. Like, it seemed like every time I'd go to jail, that'd be the time that I went, you know, the longest, and my thinking would get a little more clear, and I would start going, okay, wait, shit's kind of fucked up right now. I need a change, you know? And so I make sure it's not one of my kids or something. So I kind of, you know, came to my senses. And finally my court date came up, and I went to the court date, went in front of a judge, it was a woman judge, and she looked at my record, and she sentenced me to, at the time, because I'd been there almost a year, she sentenced me to time served plus 2 days, okay? And the point of the 2 days, as she explained to me, was so that I would not be able to get out of jail yet. She wanted me to come back. It was like on a Monday. She wanted me to come back on a Wednesday back into her courtroom, and she was going to determine what the terms of my probation were. And she wanted me to talk to this drug counselor lady on the Tuesday in the middle. Okay, and so that's why she did that. And like I said, I'd had time to sort of clear my thinking up a little bit. And so Tuesday comes, I go back to my jail, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to get out of here on Wednesday. My brother was there to pick me up, and I'm like, okay, dude, I'll see you in 2 days, you know. So I went back. On Tuesday, it was the first time in my life that this lady who I didn't know comes, and she starts asking me questions, you know. And I remember being kind of humored because she's like this person that's there going to determine, you know, if I have a drug problem or not. And she's asking me questions like, you know, do I drink more than 2 beers in a day? You know, and craziness like this. And I remember going, look, I'll just cut right to the chase. I've been, you know, shooting up for years. Are you kidding me? I just started, all of this honesty came out of me. I just started telling her, you know what? You have no earthly idea what my life's been like. And she took all these notes. She asked me 101 questions. And it went on for like hours, okay? And then finally we were done. And I remember going back to my cell and thinking, you know, something good is fixing to come out of this. You know, it's like one of the first times that I felt like, you know, maybe I'm not just going to die, you know, doing this stuff. Because for years I just went through my life thinking, this is the way my dad was. It's the way I remember him. It's the way I am. And it's the way it's just going to be until I probably die. You know, that was kind of that was my destiny in my mind, to end up like my dad. And I remember feeling kind of relief, you know, that I had just you know, been honest with somebody. And so Wednesday comes along, my court date comes back up, and I walked up in front of the same judge, and she gets the report. She's like, oh yeah, you're the one that whatever, and she gets out the stuff, and she sits there for like 15 minutes. I don't know what that lady wrote in there, but apparently the judge didn't like hearing all the shit that I had really been doing, you know. I found out later she had a, you know, she really didn't like, you know, IV drug users, you know, and I told the counselor about that, and I told her a whole bunch of stuff. And so the judge changed her mind and sentenced me to, you know, several years in prison and sent me back to my cell. And I remember turning around to my brother, and he was like dumbfounded like I was, but he was more dumbfounded looking at me like, you know, what just happened? And I wasn't. I was more just beat up to the point that I didn't even give a shit anymore. I was like, you know what? I don't even care. You know, so I go back to my cell, and I was in a 60-man cell that had one big room like this, and then there was individual cell doors that went around. And I just walked in, climbed up on my bunk, and I pulled the sheet, because, you know, you don't have like pillows and stuff like that back then. I don't know if you do now. You know, it might be, you know, down comforters or something now. And I remember I got the sheet and I pulled it up over my head and I started to cry. And you know, I wasn't upset, you know, because I was going to prison. You know, I wasn't upset for anything. It was just this emotional, overwhelming, you know, just total despair that came over me for some reason. You know, it was like everything just came out right then, you know, and looking back, you know, I had this facade up for so long going through my life, and I was, you know, wild and crazy and the whole bit, but not really. You know, I was still that little kid that was so happy and good when I was young, but I was in this adult body and all this bad shit was happening, you know. And I don't want to say that I prayed, because I don't know that I would call what I was doing praying, but I started talking to God, you know, and I was talking to him. Even though I was doing it in my brain, I was like, okay, God, you know what? I've never done this before, but I wish I could have a second chance to, you know, kind of like a mulligan, you know, like a do-over, you know. But I knew at the same time that it was, you know, I'd been sentenced, right? I knew that that was it. And, you know, if anybody's ever been through something like that, when you're sitting in jail and somebody goes from jail after court, you go to prison, you know, the guard will come up and he'll call your name and say, roll it up, you know, and that means get your stuff. Your little mat, roll all your shit up in there, and, you know, they take you and they dress you out and you get your stuff, and then they put you in a bus and you go. And I fell asleep after doing that. You know, I fell asleep. Let me turn this damn thing off. I mean, I can hear it vibrating and it's bugging me. So I ended up talking to God and I fell asleep and was sleeping for, you know, a couple of hours, I guess. And all of a sudden I was woken up by the guard yelling my name, telling me to roll it up. And I remember thinking, because I had like kind of, you know, when you go to sleep and you're thinking something, a lot of times you wake up the next morning and you're still on your brain. And I remember opening my eyes or calling my name, you know, I hear roll it up. And I remember kind of going, you know, thanks. You know, thanks for the second chance. You know, I mean, I was thinking, usually you're in there like for a day or two before they ship you off, you know, before you go up the road. And so I packed my stuff up and I followed this guard, and we're walking, and he takes me into one room, and I'm giving all my stuff, and he's giving me a bag with the, you know, bloody jeans and bloody shirt that I had on from, you know, that I had worn from the second wreck, and gives me all my stuff, and he says, come on with me. And I remember thinking it was kind of odd, because instead of escorting me, he was walking in front of me, like I was dressed in regular clothes now, and I'm following this guard, and we're just kind of walking down the way, and at the end of the hallway, there was a wet door with window, and I could see outside, and he walked me right up there to it and opened the door, and I just kept right on walking. I walked outside, and he shut the door, told me not to come back, and he shut the door. And as soon as I saw him walking down the hallway, I took off running. I was like, man, they just messed up and let me out, you know? And I called my brother, who wasn't even just barely gotten home, you know, it seemed like. He said he had just barely gotten home. Called him up. He's like, oh, my God, what did you do now? You know, he thought I had escaped, you know. And I said, man, I don't know. They just messed up. All I know is I'm outside. I'm down the street. I took off. I ran like 14 different miles, you know, different blocks. And he came and picked me up and went straight back to his place. He had some, you know, beer. He had some cocaine. And I was, no sooner was I in that house, within 20 minutes, I had a needle in my arm and a beer in my hand. And that, you know, that talking to God, where I was asking for a second chance that I had just been given, totally went out of my brain, just like that. You know, I completely forgot, you know, that person that was sitting in the cell, you know, begging for help, you know, and it went right out of my brain. Even though at that time, I meant it from the bottom of my heart. You know, I really was looking for help and I was asking for help. It turned out that, I'm not going to get into it because I'm kind of going, you know, I don't want to, I've got to get to the recovery part. You know, it ended up that it had been a technicality. They had messed something up. The judge come to find out, can't sentence you, and then sentence you again. You know what I mean? So what happened was she said 2 days, you know, time served plus 2 days. When that 2 days came, even though I went to court and she changed the sentence, that doesn't happen like that. So they let me out. And I remember I went right back to it. As much as I wanted to stop and ask God to help me, and he had just sort of stepped in and intervened, in no time at all, I was right back doing what I was doing. I proceeded down that road for a group of years, you know, bouncing in and out of rehabs. You know, I've been in 7 different treatment centers, in and out of jail, excuse me, and finally, I was coming in and out of meetings, you know, because of the different rehabs that I was going into. There was always this whole AA thing and CA. I was actually, you know, I've gotten sober with the AA big book, but for the first, you know, 20 years of my sobriety, I was actually going to CA meetings. And, you know, I was started going to meetings a lot, you know, and I was trying to get it turned around because I felt like I had a short window that I really needed to do something. You know, things just got so bad eventually that I just, you know, gave up the fight, you know, and started trying to stop. And I realized that I couldn't stop. And, you know, that was surprising to me because even though I'd used and had all the stuff happen to me that had happened to me, when I just never really stopped to think about that maybe I was going to have a hard time stopping when I wanted to stop, you know. So that was kind of, you know, puzzling to me, you know. And so I start going to all these meetings in Atlanta. And the frustrating thing was that I was doing everything that y'all were telling me to do, you know. Y'all meaning the people in meetings. You know, I would go to meetings and I would hear somebody say, you know, you got to do 90 and 90. So I would do 90 and 90. You know, you got to get a sponsor. So I would get a sponsor. You know, you've got to, you know, you have to, you know, learn how to work the steps, you know, you have to hang out with the winners, change playmates and playgrounds, and yeah, all the little cliche things that that is so you know, prevalent in AA meetings today, none of which has anything to do with recovery. But to somebody like me who was coming when I was hearing all that stuff being talked about, that's all I knew. You know, I was coming to meetings looking for an answer on how to stop, and that's what I would hear people talking about in meetings. And so I would do that. I did all of those things. I got the best sponsor there was, you know. And I was doing it all, but then I would relapse. So I'd pick myself up and think, oh, well, you know, people would tell me, oh, you did something wrong. Yeah, you got to do this. You got to do that. So I would do this and I would do that. And then I would relapse. And it started getting to this cycle that I went for years where I would always go back to meetings. I was coming in here and I was doing all the things that I thought was recovery, and none of it was working, and I kept relapsing. And even the times that I would get together a few months of sobriety, even when I was doing the best that I thought I could possibly do, everything was finally going good, my family was back around and all this, and things were looking on the up and up, I still had this notion in the back of my mind that this was not going to be forever, that I was going to do dope again, you know, that I was going to drink again, you know. And even though I didn't want to feel that way, it was always in the back of my mind that I just knew that this was part-time, you know. Well, I relapsed so many times that I literally got to the point that I gave up on meetings. And I made a literal decision one day that I was not going to go back to rehab anymore, that I was not going to go to any more meetings anymore, that I was one of those constitutionally incapable people, you know, that I just could not get it, that this worked for y'all, but y'all were not, you know, you didn't live what I've lived. And, you know, apparently the 12 steps work for lightweights, you know, that's what I used to think, you know. And that there was just no way that I was going to, that this was going to stick with me. And that I was like, well, you know what, then I'm wasting my time here. Then what am I doing? So I stopped going to meetings and just decided, you know, maybe I was meant to. Maybe my destiny was to end up like my dad after all, and that all these meetings and all these rehabs was just postponing the inevitable. And that was a literal thought in my brain, you know. And I went like that for a few weeks. And my brother, who had been clean for a little while in the middle of all this, knew that I wasn't going to any meetings anymore. And after a few weeks, he came to me one day at work. We were working together. And he came to me and he goes, man, you know what? What are you doing Thursday night? And I said, why? He goes, well, why don't you go to a meeting with me? And right away, I'm like, no, you know what? I'm not doing this anymore. It's not going to work for me. And he's like, no. This is a meeting like you've never done before. I'm telling you, I've never experienced this either. Just go. He'd only been to one meeting, like this kind of meeting. But it hit him enough that he came to me, and he was more focused on getting me there than he was about going to a second meeting. It was a book study, okay? Because he just knew in his mind that I really needed it, because he knew that I'd really just given up on everything, and he knew I was serious. And so to appease him, I said, you know what, fuck it. Okay, fine, I'll go to one more meeting just to get you to shut up. And I said it just like that to him. And so I went, and we went down to Northside Drive. There's a church over there called St. Dunstan's. And at the time, there was a Thursday night, 8 o'clock meeting. And it was a book study. It was a big book study. Only it wasn't like a book study that I'd ever been into, where people would like get a book and they'd read a paragraph, they'd pass the book around, and then everybody talk about how their dog's in heat and their girlfriend's not and all their little bullshit like that. And they would, this time I went, and instead of that, we were all sitting in these chairs, and this guy was sitting up there, and we weren't doing any talking, you know? We weren't doing anything. We weren't raising our hands. We weren't joining in at all. We were taking turns reading, and we would read like a paragraph. And then he would stop us, and then he would explain to us what that meant. And this wasn't a cross-talking thing. This was, we're there to listen to him. And I realized that we were being lectured to more than anything, right? I mean, this guy was like talking to us like we were students, you know? But I also knew that I had never heard some of the stuff that he was saying. At the time, just coincidentally or not, I don't know, it was probably by the grace of God. But at that time, they were in the doctor's opinion. And there's a paragraph in there, and I remember distinctly because it was the first time that I like was sitting there, and I decided, okay, what the hell, I'm going to listen to them and see what they're reading. And I turned around, and I was looking, and the guy reading next to me started reading this paragraph about this Dr. Stiltworth talking about men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol, you know, and without reciting the whole next couple of paragraphs, it went on to say, and this guy, Joe, that was leading the big book study, explained things to me that in all the meetings I'd been in and in all the treatment centers I'd been in, I had never heard anybody explain it quite like that. And I knew by the end of that book study, I remember sitting there and I was like, I had anxiety inside because I was wanting this meeting to end so fast because I wanted to go get that guy off to the side. And I wanted him to do whatever the hell we were doing in here, but I wanted to do it one-on-one. And so that's what I did, you know, at the end of the meeting, I mean, like, it was barely over, and I walked straight up to him. He was talking to somebody, and I literally walked up and just sort of stood in between where he was looking at this guy. I stood in the middle of it, and I said, you know what? The guy's name was Joe. I said, Joe, you don't know me from Adam, but I'm telling you right now, I really need to talk to you. I need to talk to you more than this guy right here does. And he said, and he like realized I was serious, you know, because I wasn't laughing at the time. You know, I'm like, you don't understand. I really need to talk to you. And so he said, come on. So we walked outside. And the end result of that was Matter of fact, that night, I think that he knew I was serious enough that by the time we were done talking, he had explained how he does it, you know, book studies, and explained the steps and teaches people how to recover and all that kind of stuff, and he uses the book to do it. And by the time we were done talking, I don't know what I said to him, but apparently it was enough that he goes, you know what, why don't we just go right now? And we did. You know, we literally, I jumped in my car, he jumped in his, I followed him to where he lived, and we walked in, and within about 15 minutes, I was, you know, going through the book, you know, and we sat there for hours, you know, talking about stuff. And he slowed it down for me. You know, we weren't reading a paragraph at a time. We were going like one sentence at a time, literally. And you'd be amazed at how much this guy was telling me on one sentence, you know, what it meant. And he explained to me that the book, that to me was just sort of outside literature, you know, he explained to me that it was written to be a textbook. You know, it was supposed to be used to teach people. You know, that the 12 steps on the wall, I've said this 100 times, you know, I used to go to meetings, and there'd be a step meeting, and it'd be on the, you know, third step, and there'd be 10 people talk about what the third step meant, and I would hear 10 different people talk about 10 different ways and meanings of the third step, and I would not have any earthly idea who was right, you know, because there were 10 people talking, and they all knew more than me, you know, for years. And I remember thinking, well, I don't know, what he said, is that how you do a third step, or is what you said, or what, you know? And Joe explained to me that it's not supposed to be like that. The meetings are really screwed up right now. You know, he told me that. He's like, you know, that people in going to meetings today, the success rates are really, really low. It's like 5% and 7% of the people that come into the meetings stay. You know, that's pretty serious stuff. And he's telling me this in the beginning, and I'm like, dude, look, I will do anything you ask me to do. You tell me, I will listen. I will listen to only you. And I got so tuned in to what he was explaining to me in the book and how I'm supposed to be working the steps. I got so tuned into that at one point I quit going to meetings again, because I would go to meetings and I would hear all of y'all talk, and I would sit there and I remember thinking, you know what, this is fucked up. Y'all don't know what you're talking about. This is me back then, okay? I don't mean y'all. And, you know, so I would sit there and I would get frustrated listening to people, and it bothered me to the point that I'm like, you know what, I can't even go to meetings anymore. I'm just going to go to this guy's book study. You know, we were doing it like 3 days a week, you know, and if I wasn't over there, I was at somebody else to get sponsored. I was going to their house. You know, that was like all I did. And like I said, I had been going to a lot of CA meetings for a long time, and he realized that I was now no longer going to meetings at all, and he knew my opinion of meetings. And he's the one that kind of convinced me and my brother, too, he knew we were CA, and he was like, you know, you need to carry this message back into the meetings that you're going to. You know, you don't need to just turn your back on them. You need to, you know, kind of carry the message over there. So that's what we started to do, and we started going to meetings, the old meetings that I had gone to, that I'd relapsed so many times, and that I'd picked up so many white chips, and so many people had written me off. We started carrying that message back to those people, and at first, there'd be a whole meeting, and I would raise my hand, I would talk, and then the next five people would be talking, would do nothing but dispute everything I had just said, because basically, I was, in case you can't kind of figure me out by now, I'd say what I mean, you know, and somebody would talk, and I would be like, excuse me, but, you know, that shit about killed me, you know, don't listen to what he just said, you know. And so that didn't go over very well, but one by one, there would be somebody come up to me and start asking me questions. They had been like me and had been going to meetings and could tell that they weren't getting it, and could tell that they weren't happy, and could tell that they still had that lurking notion they were going to drink or do dope or whatever. You know, there was a lot of people out there, it turned out, that were just like me. And so they started coming up to me, and a lot of them were coming up to my brother. And we started having book studies the exact same way that this guy had done me. And one by one, the meeting started to change. And my point isn't to any, like, kudos to me and my brother, because that wasn't the way I was looking at it. What I was looking at was I was seeing what I was doing myself work in other people. When I started seeing and hearing other people in the same meetings that used to dispute what I was saying, they started to agree, and they were saying, you know what, I started doing this shit the way that the book says too, and my life's changing. And the lurking notion was gone, you know, and I'm getting happy now, you know, and seeing all of them do it, and me realizing it confirmed to me that what I was doing was really real, you know, that it wasn't just me being brainwashed by what this guy had told me. Other people were we're buying into it too, you know. The end result, is it 10 o'clock? You know, I came down here, but I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to talk for a whole hour. So I'm sorry, I just realized it was after 10. I apologize. But the end result today is, as a result of me being introduced to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was taught how to work the 12 steps. You know, I learned that the steps that are usually up on the wall in a lot of meetings, that they summarize the program. They are not the program, you know. If you try to work the steps the way they're written on the wall, you're going to be really confused, you know. And it was the explanation of what those steps mean and how they're supposed to be worked is in the beginning of, you know, first section of that book. As a result, once I got a good understanding of them, I was able to then work the steps, you know. I understood what the third step meant. I understood how to do a fourth step. I did one. I did a fifth step. I went on through the process, you know, and then I found myself in the position of trying to carry the message to as many people as I could, because I realized that there was a lot of people just like me still out there in those rooms that, you know, were dying, you know, and where, you know, I was almost there, and somebody, it was by the grace of God that I met somebody that was able to teach me how to work the 12 steps, and he used that book to do it, you know. So I've spent basically from back then to now still doing it. I still have book studies at my house, you know. My brother still has book studies at his. I've never stopped, and I think the reason that I've never stopped is because, A, it's worked, so why stop, you know, why stop doing something that seems to be working all this time? But also, I know a driving factor in me continuing to carry the message the way that I do and continuing to be that guy with somebody else, having people come over to my house and teaching them how to do it too, is because I realize that there's a whole lot of people just like me, you know, that I wasn't constitutionally incapable. I was just kind of confused. You know, I needed some clarification. You know, as the end result of that is I picked up 25 years, you know, sober a few months ago, you know, and it's, you know, it was easy to do, you know. But anyway, I'll invite me back next week and I'll finish part two. I'm done. I appreciate it.